Crisps, eh? Fancy some of them.
Don't make me laugh, I'll choke.
I can't.
Ruben is currently eating a mouthful of chips. He's got no saliva to mix it and swallow it. Oh my god. Anyway, I can see the CPR. Fold when I'm on air, you know.
We're not on air, it's alright.
Yeah, I know.
We're on wine.
It's different. Wine and beer is much, much better. But, you know, like when I was building, what's it, Radio Nambucca.
Did they have a jingle?
No.
They didn't have, like, Radio Nambucca.
No.
If they did, what would it sound like?
I don't know. I haven't listened to them for years now.
We'd have to drive down to Nambucca to actually pick them up, wouldn't we?
Well, no, you can get it up here, but I can tell you some stories about it, you know, considering I was the...
Are they dirty and profane?
They do a bit of everything, actually. But some of the stories that we got up to. But I arrived on the scene, what was it? Left the Defence Force, was studying electronics through RMIT, Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, and that was my passion at the time, and I thought I was going to make a career out of electronics, and they had their aspirant license.
Aspirant?
Yes. They're aspiring to be...
Oh, aspiring.
A fully fledged broadcaster. And this is going back in the days before ACMA, the Australian Media and Communications Authority, and before the Australian Broadcasting Authority. This is going back to the days of Transport and Communications, Department of Transport and Communications. So way back in the dark ages of...
A long time. You were wearing shorts still.
Yes, FM was a new... allocated spectrum, and most of the commercial players at the time hadn't actually arrived on the FM frequency, and so I arrived there. They had their aspirant license, and they were trying to get their full license for community broadcasting. So I was helping out through that process, and I remember the day that the tech came up to do all the broadcasting tests. I was outside holding two wires together because the connector didn't work too well.
so you began your career as a connecting join
as a human alligator clip,
basically. You know, because the signal to noise ratio was just shot. So
nothing changed much then.
No, not really. So I had to hold this connector together to make sure that, you know, we got the best received signal for.
Was it a high voltage?
No, I don't think so.
If it had been, that would explain a lot. But,
but I remember there was a lot of problems with their first mixer, which they made themselves using 1980s technology. You've got to remember, this is in the 90s, early 90s, but the technology was from the 80s. And they got it out of an old Electronic Australia magazine, and then modified it and butchered it and built a broadcasting mixer with it. And through the process of, you know, with your aspirant license, there's times when you actually broadcast, you know, for the community to give an opinion and evaluate whether or not you're worthy to hold that license. But in the off times, I used to, you know, go there in the late evenings and run diagnostics and tests. And of course, you've got to put a test signal through it. And if anybody was listening, it was just a sine wave of, you know, sound a bit like this. But under the Act...
Sorry. Boop. Thank you.
Oh, it was that song.
Yeah, I think about 1,000 hertz.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was actually 950 hertz.
Yeah, yeah, it probably was. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Can you measure that?
I'll pitch shift it up.
we'll get
you're
the
like stock cake and a Mortman, aren't you?
The thing is, this is how daft it was. There's probably nobody listening to it to start with. But every 20 minutes or so, I can't remember what it was, but there was a time period where you actually had to broadcast your station identity, you know. So, you know, you'd have to say on the microphone, this is Radio Nambucca, 2MVR, test broadcast, and you would actually have to state the telephone number. But for some reason or other, I envisaged that there was, you know, tens of thousands of people actually listening to the test broadcast of...
I remember listening to it. Yeah. I enjoyed that particular broadcast.
So I thought it was John Cage's greatest hits, actually.
But as soon as I'd flick the switch for the microphone and turn it on, I would just freeze and I'd just stare at the microphone. So I'd actually have to find somebody around the place to actually come into the studio and actually state those particulars.
You please say...
No, the test generator did that. No, it's just to this day I keep on freezing.
So who is the test generator, sorry?
Matthew will be the test generator. Yeah. Yeah.
That was old Frank there. He's still down there.
Yeah, to this day I just can't do it. And then there was a few periods there where I was actually building the second studio, and they had their license, and in the early days a lot of the what do you call them, the disc jockeys, if you know Barrowville, it ran on Barrowville time, and people came when they decided to come. And there was one particular guy who was a local Aboriginal fellow, and he used to run his segment, which was reggae music. And of course one day he didn't turn up, and somebody came, you know, out of the office panicking, you know, he hasn't turned up, you know, his show's on next, what do we do? So there I am, left in the studio. Well, the first thing was I ran into the library and thinking, I don't know anything about reggae, so I just pull out Bob Marley's greatest hits. Because there's lots of albums in there, and I thought, well, you know, there's plenty of material for an hour segment. And I started playing through the album. But to make it worse, not only do you have to do things like, you know, broadcasts, you've got, well, they're not called commercials, they're called sponsorship announcements. Which are pretty easy, just cue them up and play them between songs, etc. But you're meant to actually have some sort of programming and actually talk about the track that you've just played, i.e. name the track, and have some sort of generalised opinion.
Name the
artist.
Well,
it's Bob Marley, we knew that much. But once again, I just couldn't do it. So, you know, after about the first 15 minutes, somebody comes in and says, you know, you're not actually stating what the songs are. And I said, I just can't do it. It was a lot of fun in those early days. We used to do radio plays because there was a few ex-ABC people who were right into those.
Well, they actually came into the studio and did a play.
No, we would actually move the studio. Yes, yes. Humongous studio as it was. Upstairs into the Pioneer Community Centre, and they would actually run live broadcasts. And the first radio play that they put on, it was all going well and the community was turning up. You've got to remember, you know, a lot of people up there come from the alternative lifestyle. A lot of people I met had actually done the Woodstock and all the pilgrimages associated with that. So that just gives you an idea of the people. Anyway, they were also running a tuck shop and selling things to raise money for the radio station. And they were running out of hot water, so somebody went and got another urn, plugged it in, popped the circuit breaker, took the whole radio station offline. And of course somebody says, I'll just go run out, you know, and flip the circuit breaker. So they get outside and of course there's a padlock on. So yes, the first radio play they ever did, it was offline for about 15 minutes until they could find somebody who had a set of keys. And then later on they did more broadcasts further uptown, and we used to use balanced line drivers, which meant you used out of phase signals to reduce noise.
Were you the kind of the electronic sort of monkey who made sure all the wiring worked and figured out all the technical stuff, or were you the guy who was actually talking and?
No, it was all the technical stuff. I actually built from ground up, from schematic to circuit board. Pressing metal.
My friend Cameron Bragg actually said he went to the Barrowville Museum and saw a wonderful work of art built by you.
Yes.
Do tell. Do tell.
They're not too. It looks like it came out of the 1940s. to me, that's probably my first steampunk.
What is this thing of which we speak?
It's called a broadcasting mixer. But of course, how can I describe it? It's probably a meter and a half long, half a meter high. Probably about 5 mil thick of presto aluminium, and because we were using the cheapest parts we could find at the time, because broadcasting mixers were about $10,000, and going back at that time was just outside the scope of the station, so we built everything from scratch. It was a lot cheaper, but of course the switches that we used, you have to have what they call make before break, because otherwise you have pops when you actually go from programming lines to queuing lines. Now, queuing means that you put into a line so you can listen to it, so you can get the record lined up before you actually play it to air.
Mm-hmm.
So we used X1970 Telecom switches.
Mm-hmm.
The dials were from probably the 40s or something. They were absolutely huge dials because we thought that there's a lot of disabled people, so we had to have big dials. And then because at the time the VU meters for displaying levels, the stuff at Dick Smith and everything was quite crappy and shoddy, so we would actually get the old VU meters with the needles in them that would bounce backwards and forwards.
Mm.
So when you actually put those combinations together, the thing looks like it came out of the 50s. so this console was probably only in service for a year and a half, maybe 2 years, and then somebody bought it at an auction, and then somehow it ended up in the museum. And of course the museum thought, looking at this thing, it comes out. So it's there in their collection of pride and joy, not knowing exactly where it actually came from. And
well, we've just ruined that now. They'll have to throw it out now. When they hear this,
I'm
show.
Sorry to all the people in the Pioneer Museum. Yes, it was built in 1993. But I've got to go and have a look at it. I've got pictures of it, but yeah.
Well, 1993 was a long time ago. My son was only born in 1995, and he's going to be 16.
We had dial-up internet then. That was
stone age.
But we had another broadcast where we ran a balanced line from a studio up to another hall in the town, which was a block and a half away. And of course, running on shoestrings, we got hold of old electrical wire, audio cables, and we wired it together and gaffer taped it all together, and ran this balanced line. Now the thing with balanced lines, if you get them out of phase, that's the stereo left and right. If you get them out of phase, because your transmitter doesn't actually transmit stereo, it actually transmits one channel with the difference of the second channel. So the actual bandwidth is smaller.
I have to stop you here, Paul. You're just talking a foreign language to me now, and my brain is just fuzzing over. And I'm not interested.
It's the wine.
Yeah, well, it's true.
Needless to say, basically, what it boiled down to, it was out of phase. So instead of broadcasting a stereo signal, we broadcast a signal that actually cancels itself out. So people who are actually listening to it in stereo couldn't hear anything. Mm-hmm. Those who had mono systems were picking up the broadcast fine. So we're getting this mixed message back from some people saying, we can't hear a flaming thing out here in Taylor's Arm. And then somebody else was saying, no, it's working fine here. In the end, we're working out that we had the system out of phase and the broadcast was in full swing. The only thing we could actually do was just chop one of the two lines. So we chopped the line, so then it brings it back down to mono, so then we had to bridge it and broadcast the whole thing in mono. And for those people who are overseas, yes, Australia does have some of the best wines.
I was amazed in Thailand. I think it's still the case that you go into a bottle shop, you can't get an Australian wine.
What?
You can get loads of French wine. And I can't understand why that's the case, because
heathens. I can't understand that either. You know, the French bomb atolls.
Well, I mean, especially in Southeast Asia, they have particular reason to resent the French. Well, actually, they have particular reason to resent the Australians as well. So.
No, surely not. What are you be chucking? Again,
the website. I can tell by your middle finger that you're warming up to me. Yeah, yeah.
I want to roll back your life a bit, Paul. And before you were working in the radio, is that when you were working with the... when you were in the army? The paratroopers?
We don't need to bring that up.
No, I don't know.
The dark spot.
I think our listeners need to know about when you fought for our country.
No fighting.
But
when you wore uncomfortable clothing for our country.
And jumped out of planes.
No, the clothing wasn't uncomfortable, but yeah, no, the planes were uncomfortable.
Well,
you know.
Please tell. You're on the spot now. You have to do it. You're on the radio.
I was young and naive. My parents kept on saying to me, what are you going to do with your life? And that reminds me of a song. What are you going to do with your life? Yeah, so...
You can't regret it.
I can't. So, yeah, so I joined the Defence Force, 17 years old. But I was working before that. I dropped out of school. How far do you want to go back?
No, Defence Force is a good thing. Work for George Bush. No, he wasn't in Defence Force, was he?
Well, we had no enemy at the time. We were in peace. The Americans weren't fighting any real threats back then.
So the Americans?
Yeah, well, where they go, we go, don't we?
Oh, yes. That's true.
by we mean the Americans.
What did you say?
Yes, no, I did 40 jumps in 2 years, which, you know, isn't really that much in the scope of things, because there were people there who had done over 3,500 jumps. But there was something wrong with those people.
If not before, definitely afterwards.
But yeah, no, it was interesting times. And I remember the going to the parachute training school down at Nara, and we get into the aircraft for our first jump. You know, we've done all our 2 weeks of initial training in parachuting, and we get into the aircraft for the first time. It was one of those Canadian caribous. And we take off, and of course, to me, I was freaking out because the door at the back of it was still open. To me, that was, you know, that was fundamentally flawed. You know, aircraft are meant to be completely sealed, but you know, off we go, and we're up there. And I was talking to the guy beside me, and he said, "This is the first time I've been in a plane." And I'm thinking, "Oh no, first time in a plane, you're not going to land in it."
Oh, but my God. Yeah,
the first jump was surreal. You know, it was like riding one of those big slippery dips. You know, you get out and you get bumped around, and you know, there's a lot of noise. And I think I forgot all the procedures. I didn't even check to see if the parachute was open. But in the Defence Force, you don't land, you arrive. So that was my first jump. And then as we progressed further, we then got into the we did I think 3 jumps out of caribous, and the fourth one was out of the C-130 Hercules. That's one of those big four-propped cargo planes, and
they're great at complaints, Hercules.
Yeah, but this is the first time out of what they call sim doors. You jump out the side of the plane rather than the back of the plane. Anyway, I kept on saying, because I was absolutely petrified by this time and scarred for life, that this is not normal. People aren't really meant to fly, and people aren't definitely meant to exit the aircraft whilst it's flying.
Well, not a perfectly good aircraft. No.
Yes. Nothing wrong with this plane. Why am I getting out of it?
Yeah, so I said, whatever you do, I don't want to be at the end of the stick. And the stick is a small group, and then the sortie is the whole aircraft. They've got different names for different things. And so I don't want to be at the stick. I said, if I'm at the end of the stick, I probably won't jump, And they say most people start to fail parachuting around about the fourth jump, because by that time you really have woken up to what's going on.
It actually is quite dangerous, isn't it?
Well, I don't think it's dangerous, I think it's
foolhardy, perhaps.
Yeah, but anyway, so at the same time they also train what do you call it, the loadies.
Yeah,
they train the dispatch at the same time. So you're learning to parachute, and other people are learning to assist you out of the aircraft.
Assisting
out of the aircraft. They have big boots. They would put the hand, one of their hands on the back of you, and the other on the shoulder, and they would assist you out of the aircraft. But their job was also to make sure everybody got out of the aircraft safely. And they would also count the stick to make sure that everybody got out. And of course, there's the guy at the front, and he's counting out 1, 2, 3, and he gets to 8, and he's looking around, because 9's missing. There I am at the other end of the aircraft where the cockpit is, shaking my head, going, no, no, I'm not going anywhere. Anyway, of course, I had, the different people there with different rank basically saying to me that if I failed to jump out of the aircraft, well, meanwhile they're turning this aircraft around, by the way, to actually give me another chance to actually jump out. And there's another guy on the other side of the aircraft who didn't go out the door either. I remember his name is King. You only ever remember people by their last names, because that's all you were. You're either a number or a last name. And they're trying to encourage him to jump out of the aircraft as well. And, he's going through the mental breakdown as I was. Anyway, they're going through all the psychological mumbo-jumbo. Anyway, it came down to this. The guy said to me, I think he was a sergeant, he said to me, if you don't jump, you'll have to leave the unit and you'll go to mechanized. And I thought, nobody wants to be in a tin can. It's just a target and it melts. So I was straight down the end there and I jumped out. I arrived on the ground and I copped a lot of abuse. But most of the abuse was to the fact that at the time, and this is going back in the 80s, it cost them $5,000 just to turn the aircraft around. So it was an expensive exercise.
I'm having a lot of trouble with rabbits in my lounge room. I think I'll have to get one of them set top foxes.
How I ended up in paratrooper, I was at Kapooka, basic training, and our staff at the time said, would there anybody here would like to volunteer to do voluntary jumping if you had the opportunity? All you have to do is to tick this box on this form and sign your name. And I thought, yes, if I was given the opportunity, I'd love to jump out of a plane. Now, they were selling this pitch as, they fly over water and, you just have a bit of a yippee jump out of the plane. I thought, yeah, this would be a good thing. I'm in the Defence Force. So I ticked this box. I bypassed initial employment training, which is, you do your core training, and I went straight to the unit. Did not go past go. I did not collect my $200.
Sucked in.
Yeah. So I spent my 3 years there, and I made a personal vow that if I'd made 40 jumps and survived without a malfunction, I would quit, or I'd quit if I had a malfunction. And I made it to the 40th jump.
If you have a malfunction, do you that'd be, actually it'd get
be all
to
over
quit?
Red Rover.
It's like, well, I quit because I'm now strawberry jam.
It only happened to two people, as far as I know.
Mind you, then two people, that sounds safer than the job I had when I was in London. I mean, I worked as a motorcycle courier, and every single week, one of my team would be in casualty with fairly
extensive wounds.
They wouldn't come back. You wouldn't hear from
missing
again.
Legs, arms.
Yeah, it was a very common thing to, you know, to hear on the motorcycle courier grapevine in London. To, you know, we were generally universally hated by everyone else in London because, you know.
So you were a target. There's the courier.
I was a target, but at the same time, I knew I was a target. Therefore, everyone else was a target. You become very aggressive, and you ride around like an absolute, dare I say it, on the public radio, a fucking maniac. I remember going down.
That's why people hate couriers.
Yeah. It's completely right. They should be hated and vilified, really. But you know, we defend ourselves, and wing mirrors disappear fairly quickly as we go down traffic queues. A very common technique is to, cowardly, but a very common technique is to pick the most foolhardy, you know. We started this podcast with the whole greenhorn wet behind the ears thing, but one of those greenhorns who were wet behind the ears, you'd follow the new guy down and he'd be from Australia probably, you know. He's like, oh, g'day mate, I just got a job as a motorbike courier. You go, off you go mate, oh, you're pretty fast, aren't you, see how fast you can go. Oh, except I had an English accent back then. I was like speaking with my Cornish accent, going, here, mate, why don't you go as fast as you can? You're very impressive for an Australian. So they take off.
That's the least convincing Cornish accent I've ever heard.
Get fuck, you wanker. Yeah, okay. I concede. So they take off down the traffic queue, and you'd follow them. And I was doing this one day on the North Circular Road, going past the new IKEA store that had just opened in London. It was very exotic. Ooh. And this poor Australian sucker who was in front of me, somebody opened their door in the traffic queue, which they lost instantly as this guy drove into it. They opened the door, his bike struck the door, the door folded and flew off, and this guy just went down the traffic queue like a billiard ball going.
Is that when you turned off and went up an alleyway?
I just cruised along behind him as he cleared the space for me, and there must have been about 20 cars that were severely damaged. And he was fine, actually. He was lucky, actually. He kind of got up at the end and went, fuck me, my bike's ruined, mate. It's like, errol, that's what happens when you're driving in London. Hell, I sound like a Pakistani. How do we get into motorcycle couriers?
So this all demonstrates to me what a boring life I've led. Because I'm, as I've said many times, I never drove a car until we moved up here 5 or 6 years ago, and I was in absolute panic being taught how to drive a car. First, Alison had a go at teaching me how to drive a car, and then we both got very sick of her sort of clapping her hands to her eyes and screaming,
watch out for the bicycle,
the crazy motorcycle,
what are you doing,
courier?
stop we had enough of that, and then a very, very nice chap whose name I can't remember, and I really regret that because I'd like to give him a plug. We paid this guy to teach me how to drive, and he very, very patiently taught me how to do it. And I think, well, obviously, most of what he does is teaching 16-year-old kids how to drive. So he's not used to teaching
elderly,
you know,
geeks.
Yeah, 30-somethings how to drive. And I said to him, there's no question of enjoying this. I'm in a ton of metal hurtling along the road at 80 to 100 kilometres an hour. How on earth can anyone consider this to be fun? And my question to you, Paul, is what do you think of people who do parachuting for fun, recreationally? Are they completely bonkers?
I think they are. It's not an experience that I enjoyed for those 2 years. There's just nothing normal about it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't understand the adrenaline rush that people try to seek. You know, to me, I like to conserve the adrenaline for when I actually need it. And that's right. I like the idea of flight. And talking about flight, one of the things that, you know, when you're actually on the battlefield, and the Australians are very good at this, something goes wrong, you know, and there's lots of screaming and shouting and weapons firing backwards and forwards. And then when you find out that, you know, the group that you've actually come in contact with are twice the size of your group or 10 times the size of your group, you then suddenly hear somebody say, "Run away! Run away!" and the thing is, mostly
clapping coconut shells behind them.
But that's where it all comes from. And the thing is, it's reality. And the amount of times of all the exercises I've done, the amount of times that we spent running away, and you know, when you do go on major exercises, for some reason or other, the unit I was in was always the enemy. We were Cimmerians. Cimmerians were a fictional country which was basically Indonesia in disguise.
Hmm.
But you couldn't say that because that would be considered, you know, politically incorrect.
There's probably a WikiLeaks about it. The Cimmerians, they're really the Indonesians.
Oh no, surely not.
And the thing is, we always used to operate in small groups, you know, 5 to 9 people. And sometimes we'd come together and there'd be a platoon, which would be, you know, 29 or 30 odd people. But on the whole, small groups. But of course, the rest of the Defence Force is actually doing it in their larger groups of company, which might be 130, or battalion, which might be, you know, 300 to 500, depending on their strengths.
Hmm.
And so therefore, when you're actually walking through the bush, you know, and then you're suddenly confronted by this mass of bodies in front of you, you know, you don't want to hang around, you know. You know, and these are not really the enemy, these are just soldiers on the other side of the war games, because I tell you what, if they get hold of you, you find yourself, you know, in your underpants with a hessian bag on your head.
It sounds like a wedding night outside the Planto Hotel.
That happened a lot, actually. But yeah, so every time we saw them, we ran away. And I remember one particular day, we were up in the Northern Territory. What was it? Daly River, I think it was around there somewhere. And the maps we had were quite old. And we walked into, I can't remember who it was, but I can't remember if it was Wanra or something like that. But they were operating at company strength. We had somehow walked, because, you know, they might have one platoon up front and two in the back. Somehow we walked into the middle of them. Don't ask me how. And stupid us, you know, we should read the signs. You know, we were walking along the bush and all of a sudden a whole pile of wild brumbies go bolting past. And I turn around and sort of like think, well, you know, this is abnormal. You know, sort of like, what do we do? Well, we've got a particular task. Keep on going. So there I am. I walk over this ridge line and there they all were down there. So I look down there. They look at me. I lay on the ground. And I'm trying to do hand signals, so I've got my hands extended and going, you know, like in big circular motion, trying to indicate big, and then I'm pointing my thumb down to the ground, indicating enemy. And of course, my section commander at the time is just sort of like looking at me, who has no idea what's on the other side of the ridge line, putting his hands up, sort of like saying, "I don't know." You know, once again, flailing arms, big. Enemy. and the thing is, I did this for about a minute, you know, and you know, here we are, we're in bang smack in the middle,
you know, the between best signal sandwiched there for you to be shot.
Well, that's we what know. That's what started happening, you see, because they were then, they had realized, you know, because like I said, I walked out of the top, they saw me, I saw them, And of course, in reality, I should have just fired as many bullets as I could have at them and ran away. But I'm trying to figure out how the frick do I get out of this, because they're up over there, they can run away, but I can't. So I stand up, they're going to start taking pot shots at me. And sure enough, they start taking pot shots as though we're doing the what they call a flank attack. Anyway, so run away, run away. So we start hoiking it out there. We come to the highway. Now we have areas of operation, and they tell you where you can operate, where you can't. The reason being is if you go into another area of operation, you could be brassed up by your own crew. That way, you know, it's like a physical boundary, so you can't accidentally get shot by the wrong people. We thought, stuff this, straight over the top of the highway. And we ran up the other side of the highway, and of course they were upset because their area of operation also was the highway, so they came to the edge of the highway and stopped. And when we get back to base, there's a complaint because
we cheated.
But anyway, we're looking at the map.
Dirty rotten cheats.
No. As we're running along, we notice on the other side there's all this old dirt road and everything, and it's, you know, the highway's dead straight, but the old road's squiggling all over the place. And so when we get back, we're looking at the map and realise that the map was so old that it marked the old highway, not the new highway. So we actually
just like a councillor, get up on a technicality.
But yeah, there was lots of running away. I just remember that all the time. Run away.
Well done. I like that.
So therefore, now you know the Australian Defence Force tactic.
I have what I like to think of as a very distinctive personal driving style, which is basically
all about. Do you wear hats?
No. Okay. I have been known to keep a hat on the back seat of the car just to demonstrate that I'm an old git. And you should watch out if you're driving.
This hat could be on my head at any moment, and yes, then you will have to cope with the consequences. Yeah. Yeah.
But I base my whole. I mean, driving for me is just a challenge of trying to keep focused on the task at hand, which is always a struggle for me, and is a particular worry if you are in a ton of metal hurtling down the road. You don't want your mind to wander. No. But my mind is particularly well suited to wandering, so I have to make driving.
That's now we've figured out why Matthew can't stick to one task.
I have to turn driving into a game. So my particular game is all about conservation of
home.
No, it's all about conservation.
Win 10 points.
It's all about conservation of momentum. If I brake, I lose points. If I accelerate too hard, I lose points. I just want to let physics do the work for me. So I'm probably a very frustrating person to drive behind. And I also get very frustrated about people who are in front of me.
You overtake them and then immediately like just drift to a slow halt.
There's the point where there's a... In Coffs Harbour, there's always the point where the roundabout is coming up and where you get the sign that says 60 kilometres ahead.
Yeah.
And that's the point at which you just slip into neutral and cruise your way down to 60, so that when the 60 sign hits, you're at 60. When you hit the roundabout, you're at 40 and you're able to comfortably take the roundabout. And then you slip the car back into gear and you start accelerating very gently, so that when you go through the 60 sign, you're at 60. When you go through the 80 sign, you're at 80.
Which would make you a great driver.
That's what you're meant to do.
Yeah.
No wonder you failed.
It's not what you're meant to do. You meant to go to the 60 sign and go, 60 miles an hour. 80 miles an hour. 20. Woo!
That's what everybody else is doing. No wonder people get frustrated.
Yeah.
I
like that philosophy, and I'm going to adopt it from now on. I'm going to just try.
Turn driving into a game.
No, conservation of energy. I like the idea of just cruising along and easing on. And that would make you such a good driver. I mean,
Yeah, but the vehicle may be conserving energy, but what about Matthew? Average person's meant to be doing about 40 to 60 watts of power. I reckon Matthew's between 80 and 100 watts of power, just concentrating on
I could be using that energy to be on a mobile phone at the time that I'm driving.
I hadn't thought of that. My God, I could be having a conversation with my long lost school friend. I've been browsing on my WAP, you know, internet phone whilst I was driving, texting them, squashing cyclists as I went. Crunch all was that. Oh. We can get together without coming to blows. Yeah. That's from the world.
There's so much to say, but not enough time to say it. Should we sign off?
I'll get fucked, a lot of you. I'm done.
Yeah. Adios, amigos. Hasta la vista.
Good night. Sleep tight. Are we sitting comfortably, children? Then let's begin.
I think I'm drunker than you are.
No, hang on. I think I'm drunkler.
Drunklier?
I think I'm more drunkly than you're drunkler.
Oh, I think I'm drunklier than you are.
No, I didn't drink this now, and I'll be more drunkly drunkler than you get drunk.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, you go online
and you know a business exists.
He's still going, Matthew.
Yeah, and you Google it. And but the thing is, you come back with, you know,
he's like the Energizer Bunny of counsellors.
He is, isn't he? He's got Duracell batteries up his bum.
Only at night time. I come awake when at night. During the morning, I'm just forget it. You know.
Yeah,
I don't get motivated until about 8 o'clock.
I'm going to come around to your place tomorrow at 5 o'clock and see with a microphone.
I'll be away
and interview you.
Mm-hmm. I'll be cooking breakfast.
No, I won't come around to your place
because we're actually going out to a park to cook breakfast. So that'll have to be done about 7 o'clock because the kids want to go out, and because I've got my niece at home as well.
I don't know, 5 o'clock. I'll be there at 5.
We'll be out having bacon and eggs. I'm not sure of it.
Deranged animal.